The Google Podcast app is going away in April. Right now, I want you to take a look at the podcast app you're using right now. Maybe it's time for a new one. Check out podcastapps.com and try a new one for free right now. That's podcastapps.com.
Hi, I'm Paul Myers. I'm an author, musician, and podcaster, and I'm looking forward to digging deep.
Welcome to Digging Deep, presented by Zen Books and Abacus Data. I'm Mark Sutcliffe, and I'm on a quest to learn from the best. Do you ever listen to someone talking about something they love, and even if you're not as interested in that subject as they are, you just can't help but feel their infectious enthusiasm? That's how I feel listening to the Record Store Day podcast. It's hosted by a guy named Paul Myers. And Paul's love for music and everything about it just infuses the show. And I can't help but get into it. Paul is a really interesting person. He grew up in a creative family. His parents were really into music and comedy. And his younger brother is Mike Myers, the comedian and actor from Saturday Night Live and the Austin Powers movie franchise. Paul is a musician, a songwriter, a journalist, and the author of several books. In our discussion today, we talk about where Paul's love of music began. And here's a spoiler alert. Paul's parents are from Liverpool, and there's a famous band from that city you may have heard of that's a big part of the story. And Bugs Bunny plays a role too. Paul's career has taken him to some amazing places. He's written books about Long John Baldry, Todd Rundgren, the Bare Naked Ladies, and the Kids in the Hall. He's interviewed Elton John, and he spent time in Alcatraz with Stevie Nicks. Now he's working on a new book about comedian John Candy. He tells us all of those stories, and also about the role that luck has played in everything that's happened in his life, and he says it very early in this episode, he considers himself lucky to be here at all. But it's not all about luck. There's been a lot of hard work, too. Paul talks about how great it is to get to do something he loves, but he also has a lot to say about how challenging it can be sometimes and the pitfalls of doing project work and freelance gigs. There are some great lessons as well. Paul talks about taking chances, how you shouldn't waste time worrying about whether you're good enough at something or whether other people think you're good enough. You don't need to be perfect before you launch yourself into something you want to do. He talks about embracing change, like he did when he went from aspiring to be a rock star to instead writing books and hosting podcasts. He talks about making meaningful connections, like how an interview with the legendary Randy Bachman ended up with Paul joining Randy on stage for a concert and even getting an invitation to his wedding. Paul also speaks very candidly about his relationship with alcohol and how a question from his wife more than 20 years ago put him on the path to sobriety. It's something that he still shares widely today, offering words of wisdom to anybody who needs to hear them. We also talk about the connection between music and memory, how the first few notes of a song can take you to a long-forgotten time or put you in a room with somebody that you deeply miss. Paul puts it perfectly when he tells us, "Music travels through the air, but it goes into your heart." I think you're going to take away a lot from this discussion. There's so many great stories and really interesting perspectives that Paul shares with us. So one last thing before we get started, I would really appreciate it if you would subscribe to this podcast and review it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. And if you haven't done so already, please subscribe to my weekly newsletter, The Weekly Dig. It's a very quick 2-minute read. It has 5 really useful lessons each week that you can apply to your life and to your work. Lots of people are reading it every week and they're enjoying it. So please give it a try. You can subscribe at letsdigdeep.com. That's letsdigdeep.com. You can find more about this episode of the podcast there as well. Now, let's start digging deep with musician, journalist, podcaster, and author, Paul Myers. Paul, it's a real pleasure to welcome you to Digging Deep. I'm really excited to meet you. I have been reading and listening to your work quite a lot over the last couple of weeks to get ready for this and really enjoying it. And what I love about what you do is that it's obviously, you know, really based around your passion for music. And, you know, what I find is when you're passionate about something like that, even if your listeners and your readers aren't as into music as you are, they're still, you know, they're picking up on your enthusiasm and feeding off of that. And it's, and I think there are a lot of lessons in that. So I'm really enjoying what you're doing and looking forward to this conversation. Thank you for doing this.
Well, thank you. That's a nice, flattering way to open the show. So I appreciate that entirely.
And I'm looking forward to talking about a lot of different things some of the really cool stuff you've done in your career. But let's start at the beginning. And what would you say is your fondest childhood memory?
You know, I was thinking about this, and I was going to say listening to Revolver on my 11th birthday, but it's actually going to England when I was 14 years old.
Going to England when you were 14.
With my family. Yeah, flying from Toronto, Canada to England. We landed in London. It was just, it was mind-blowing.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. And of course, you have, like I do, you have some heritage from Northern England. So we'll get into that a little bit. Who was your hero when you were 10 years old?
Well, it's going to be a theme here because when I was 10 years old, I was probably nothing else but the Beatles. The Beatles 100%, which is relevant, I guess, lately, because it's called coming back to me. But, when I was 10 years old, it was the Beatles for sure.
Cool. And was there one in particular that was your favorite?
You know, I'm not supposed to say this because I don't like to play favorites, but I identified with Paul McCartney because his name's Paul. And because, I don't know, I guess I just really dug his, he performed outward to the camera more. So you felt like he was talking to you. Especially yeah. in Let It Be.
Yeah. And I have to say, like, we'll get into this later, but I never really had a favorite Beatle until recently. And I've been getting my kids to listen to the Beatles, and I have been consuming. And of course this big Peter Jackson thing has come out. Right. So, and I find I'm more connected to Paul than I thought I was compared to the others. So I've discovered I have a favorite Beatle too.
Yeah. Well, we can talk about that later. We'll follow up on that.
What did you think you were going to be when you grew up?
Well, here's the theme again. Because I was so identified with the Beatles, I really thought what a great life that would be to write songs, record them, and, you know, be a musician and record producer. Because I couldn't imagine anything else.
Wow. And you got to do a lot of that. So there you go.
Yeah, some of it. Yeah, yeah.
That's great. What is your life story in 6 words?
I'm extremely lucky to be here.
Okay.
Yeah, that's 6 words. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm extremely lucky to be here.
Why do you say that?
Because I think there's been a series of almost, you know, like random, I can now see somehow I made choices, but a lot of times there were just things that fell into place that positioned me for the life I have. And, you know, even when I'm not feeling great about a day or even a month or a year, I can say to myself, you know, it's been pretty good. And where I am, you know, it's like philosophical. You start to think, well, I wouldn't have had these great things happen if those other things had gone through the way they were supposed to in my mind. So I'm just extremely lucky and just really grateful, you know?
Yeah. And for what do you feel most grateful?
Well, this is going to sound sappy and there's a bit of a theme here, but I honestly feel grateful that I'm in a loving relationship with someone who, just one of those rare things where you can meet one person and spend your whole life with them, you know, and it's just, and this, my wife, she's just very every day inspiring and she supports me. I support her. I hope I support her as much as she supports me. And we've just had so many adventures together. And I'm just really, really grateful that we're doing this all the time. We get to do things together. So I'm very lucky.
That's beautiful. Yeah. That's nice to be able to say that.
To be able to know it is kind of neat, because wouldn't you hate to miss that? Wouldn't you hate to like end your life and go, wow, I never really appreciated how good things were.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I have the same thing, and I'm equally grateful. And that's always my answer to that question as well. But it is, you know, it's precious. It's, you know, not everybody gets to have that. And I'm thankful that I do.
Mm-hmm.
What's been the best year of your life so far and why?
You know, this one's pretty good. I did a lot of things this year that were kind of new for me. And I was, you know, just in a, and I could, if you want, these are the fast opening questions. If you want me to elaborate on them, I can, but, just a lot of good things happened. I had some new experiences this year that, allowed me to travel in a year when it was probably hard to travel for a lot of people. And I traveled safely and I did some new experiences and new kinds of projects that I'd never done before. And I, again, with the grateful theme, just it's an incredible year.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's come back to that. What's been the toughest year of your life so far?
You know, I saw you let me see this question ahead of time. My dad had Alzheimer's disease and it was at a time, it was, you know, 92. Well, actually it was in 89 that he started getting symptoms of Alzheimer's disease, and just watching his decline. And I was, you know, I was an alcoholic and, you know, I guess I still am, but I was drinking in those days. And there was a lot of turmoil in my life and a lot of decisions I made, and ways I behaved and reacted to things and anger and all those things. And so when I think back, that was a pretty brutal time, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That's tough. What one person would you say has had the greatest impact on your life?
Well, back to my wife. I mean, you know, one likes to think that one would have socialized normally and learned basic rules of organization and getting your life in order. But I was just really lucky that just my wife's got a real short sense of she's not complacent. She always wants to find the best thing. And she's, you know, she's somebody who will make make suggestions to her of her own life. I mean, just and to be around that influence, and that, you know, she's just been a really good influence on me that way, and made me sort of also see where my own potential was. So just again, back to the theme of being incredibly lucky, you know.
Yeah, that's nice. And you know, it's funny because when you first came on the call, I overheard you saying to someone, I'm going to be talking about you a little bit.
And
obviously that was, you were saying that to your wife because you knew that she was going to be the answer to a bunch of these questions, which is
Well, I gave her a heads up about that too.
Nice. What's the most important lesson you've learned that you would share with others?
Oh, okay. You know, don't waste time worrying about whether you're good enough at something. And don't waste time worrying about whether people think you're good enough at something, because I spent a great way too much time worrying about whether I'd be seen as this or seen as that. And thinking that I had to be perfect before I could do anything. And that, you know, so I guess the advice would be to be happy to surprise yourself. You might actually be really great and you might also not be, but if you really like something, it's corny, right? But it's true. You just keep doing it for you to the point where it's like buffing, you know, polishing something, you eventually starts to shine. And also you might lose interest if you're not that good in it, you might just find something else. And so, you know, the analogy I used to make, it's kind of overdone, is if you're a little kid and you see everyone playing in the water and you jump in the water because it looks like it's going to be fun and you just think that'll be fun and you don't know how to swim, you find yourself going, oh, this isn't so much fun. I'm actually about to drown if I don't take care of myself here. So I got to figure this out. So suddenly survival is the new game. And then you find out a whole bunch of other things. And then you either learn to swim or you go, man, I'm not getting in the water again. And at least you did it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I guess the trick is to not do it on the things like jumping out of a plane without a parachute. Like
right.
Things that will literally kill you aren't a good lesson for you. But very few things that we are afraid of are as life and death as we think.
Yeah.
I think.
So
I mean, that's a generalization.
Yeah. If you're not particularly good at skydiving, don't try that. And just about anything else. And, you know, when you talk about that, it makes me think, not so long ago, I read Bruce Springsteen's book you know, he's a guy who wanted to play the guitar and spent a ton of time in his bedroom by himself playing the guitar. And I imagine he was probably pretty bad at first. Right. And
yeah,
you know, that it's, you got to put the time in and have that passion that even if you're not that good at it at first, don't be thinking, I'm terrible at this. So I have no potential. Just keep at it. Right.
Yeah. I mean, Malcolm Gladwell is a little bit out of fashion, but the 10,000 hours thing is a great, you know, yeah. The idea that, you know, it does takes a few times to get good at something, you know?
Yeah. What would people be most surprised to learn about you?
I really can't say, because lately I've been living my life so publicly, like people know a lot about me. Like I just told you, I was, that I'm a recovering alcoholic, and that, you know, that my father had Alzheimer's disease, and you barely know me. So it's hard to surprise people. I guess some people have seemed surprised that I have no confidence and that I'm an introvert, because I've basically been masquerading as an extrovert for the last 20, 30 years.
Right. Yeah.
So I guess, you know, to paraphrase REM, everybody hurts, you know? So, I mean, there's times when I have no confidence whatsoever. And then there's times when I just have to have the confidence. And luckily for me, most of the time I get to go out and do something that is scary. It's scary to me. I'm on a personal level. It's not scary like trying to cure COVID or anything. Like it's in perspective. I'm not a doctor, you know?
And what's your secret talent? You obviously have lots of very obvious talents that you've put to work in so many different ways, but do you have a secret talent?
I mean, it's not a joke answer, but I recently discovered that I could make a really good pizza. I had no idea that I could do that. And I guess it's pretty easy ultimately, but, let me think, you know, the secret, something that it's always a secret to me is that when I have to fix something like technical, I always think I have no concentration skills, and I've had like various mentors who are good at fixing things for me, like about audio engineering or photography. But sometimes I'm pretty good sitting down with a rule book or an instruction manual, so to speak, and just like at least getting the precepts, you know, and just understanding what's needed. And then I go, oh yeah, you plug this into here and look, it's working. And to me, that's a secret talent that I do, but that's a secret to myself. I mean, I'm always surprised that I can do that. So I don't know. There aren't many secrets around me, it seems.
Yeah. What's the most fun that you've ever had?
Oh, well, my wife and I went in 2001, we just basically left our lives. We were living in San Francisco. We'd moved from Toronto to San Francisco in 1997. And then in 2000, we weren't really digging the jobs we had visas for. So we knew we'd have to move probably back to Canada. We didn't know what we were going to do. We really liked the West Coast. So we thought, let's just put everything in storage. And I think we had some money from something. I can't remember what it was, but we were saving money on rent. So we were just backpacking through Asia for about 7 months, 6.5 months.
Wow.
And we went to Nepal, Vietnam, India, Malaysia, Thailand, Bali, and then Japan. And I mean, we went to Singapore. I guess that counts as a different place, although it just feels like the tip of Malaysia, but Singapore, and then Bali, and then Japan. And then we moved to Vancouver right after that. Like we came to San Francisco and then got what was left and put everything in a truck and found a place in Vancouver. So that was like just incredible fun. I mean, and just a fantasy to basically do that.
Well, and the other thing that strikes me about that, Paul, is that, you know, you weren't 19 or 20 at that time, right?
I mean, I was not.
Yeah. So, you know, that sort of backpacking across Asia is kind of something that people might do around their university years, but you and your wife were already well into your careers and, you know, so that's really cool.
Well, you know, it's also, you either do it on your university years or you do it in your senior citizen years.
Yeah.
You know, and we were doing it at a point where we were kind of between lives. You know, we started again in Vancouver, and, you know, that's a whole other story if you want to elaborate on that. But like so many things happened in Vancouver for us that we had no idea about when we left San Francisco to go on this trip. We didn't know what the other side would look like, which is in itself kind of a life lesson, you know. Just you don't know what's on the other side. So we just went ahead, you know, I don't know who those people were, but they were fearless.
Yeah. I admire that because, you know, I think we all sort of have this impression that, you know, if we Like, let's say you've got a full-time job and you think to yourself, hey, if I ever get fired, I'm going to take 3 months off and I'm going to travel, or I'm going to read, or I'm going to write a novel or whatever. And if that ever actually does happen, it's very hard to go ahead for a lot of people and take that 3 months and do that thing, because they spend most of that time worrying about what their next job is going to be afterwards. And yeah, it's very hard to kind of just enjoy that interim period for what it is, because you have uncertainty about the future. And it sounds like you just sort of embraced and jumped into that.
That's not to say we weren't concerned. I mean, especially at the end, I remember we were somewhere in somewhere around the end, Malaysia around there, it was kind of the middle towards the end. And we were starting to be concerned about where we were going to live and what we were going to do when we got there. But, you know, we were also kind of distracted by temples and things we had to see. So, you know, and I remember actually going to Japan after being in some of these places where you could backpack for very cheap. And then we get to Tokyo where, you know, you can't buy a croissant without spending $17. So, and just, you really realize that how much you appreciated that like $2 pad thai that you had like five nights ago. So, So the practical considerations were there. And I mean, it's amazing what happened though. We just ended up becoming kind of a small fish in a small pond of the media scene in Vancouver. Like Lisa worked for the Vicky Gabbro show, and I had a radio show. I was writing for the Georgia Strait and got on a national TV show, and I got another book deal. All these things happened while I was in Vancouver. So nice. Yeah, again, you know, leap in the net will appear, one hopes.
Yeah.
One never knows. And that's what makes it, I guess that's what makes it interesting.
Yeah. What's your boldest prediction for the future?
Oh, that's a tough one, man. I'm not saying I'm pessimistic necessarily, but I mean, I don't know. I think things are going to continue to be bad, and the difference is we might adapt. I worry, honestly, not to get too heavy, but I worry that the amount of ignorance that's running rampant about how to handle pandemics, and then inversely, how people are tribal about, you know, left and what right politics, mostly in my case, I react against the right. I don't understand far right politics at all. And it seems to be dug in places. And I just don't know how we get out of it. I don't know what happens. I mean, I live in the United States, which probably doesn't help, but I know that I have family in Ontario still, and it's not any better there in some ways.
Yeah. And I share that concern. And so a couple thoughts on that. First of all, I've been struggling lately to figure out like, what is the path back for the United States out of this period of deep division? And I can't figure it out. So I hope somebody has the answer, or events just sort of conspire to make people get back together. But it's hard to foresee,
you know,
how that would unfold.
We just watched Paul Thomas Anderson's Magnolia again. And
I love that movie.
Yeah. But his way out of breaking out of it was to have a reign of frogs.
So exactly.
That will happen.
Yeah. Yeah. If you haven't seen the movie, basically at a critical juncture when everything is about to fall apart for all the key characters, a bunch of frogs just start falling from the sky.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah.
That old frog device that you see in so many movies.
Exactly. Let's hope that, you know, there's reason to be more optimistic. So if you were giving a commencement address to a bunch of students today, what would be your message?
This is something that I'm adapting from Mel Brooks. Mel Brooks said, expect the worst. Was it hope for the best and expect the worst? And I would say hope for the best, prepare for the worst. Because I feel like that's a good way to travel. I mean, you want to hope for the best. So you want to be optimistic, and you want to like think about the thing you're going to be doing that you want to see, you know, and so you're working towards that, and then being a little bit pragmatic about it. And this goes back to that thing about maybe you're not going to get it right away. Maybe, you know, when I was talking about earlier, like it's going to take a few attempts, you know? And if you give up early, you might not get there. And, you know, you can always reassess as you go along. I mean, the one thing I don't want to tell anyone is to just keep trying. If it's really not good, if you're really not, you can get out of it. Yeah. If you said you were going to be a house painter and you want to be the best house painter, and then you find out whatever, you know, the analogy is that maybe you're allergic to paint and you think, well, maybe this really wasn't my calling. And if, like, I was going to be a rock star and record producer, and I ended up writing books and doing podcasts, and I just started working in film. So maybe I wasn't going to be a rock star. And if you told me that when I was 16, I would have said, get the hell out of here, you know? So yeah. I had to figure out, it's not giving up, it's changing, you know? Maybe it's giving up too, I don't know.
Yeah, but I think that's a really important lesson. We can come back to your journey, because I think what's really cool about what happened to you and what you made happen is that you ended up finding, you know, you're still in the music space. You're still, you know, you're absorbed in something you love. You're just not absorbed in the way you expected to be when you were 16, which is, and that's appealing and cool. I think the other thing, you know, I see people go on Shark Tank all the time where they, you know, they come out and they say, I've got this business idea and here's what I'm doing. And the sharks will say, it's not a very good idea. And they'll say, how much money have you invested so far? And they'll say, well, I've put everything I have into it, and I've mortgaged my house, and everybody keeps telling me I should give up, but I know I shouldn't. I should just keep going. And sometimes when everybody tells you should give up, you should give up. You know, as much as there are stories of people who are told over and over again, hey, don't, you know, this isn't for you, and they persist and they become Olympic champions, or they write a, you know, they write a great novel or whatever. Sometimes when everyone's telling you this is not a good idea, it's not a good idea.
Yeah. I always get the actual words of the Serenity Prayer. Right. But one of them is to know the difference.
Yeah.
You know, to know, change the things you can't change, to not change the things you can't change, and whatever, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I hope you look up the Serenity Prayer, because I just garbled it.
No, it's to have the power to change the things you can change.
Accept the things you cannot change, and to know the difference.
Yeah, the wisdom to know the difference.
The wisdom to know the difference is the magic trick.
It's the secret to life, practically.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
You've written several books. Is there a book that you are most likely to recommend to other people? Is there a book that's had a big impact on you?
By other people?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's quite a few. You know, on a practical level, I read Stephen King's book on writing, and I will never want to write probably like Stephen King or in that genre. And I don't even write fiction, but the book was so inspiring about how to approach the thing that I do. And just also, he's such a good storyteller about his own life.
Yeah.
And
it's a great book.
Yeah. It made a lot of things make sense to me. So I recommended that to a lot of people. I've also recommended Mark Harris's books on film, the Mike Nichols one being the recent one. Mike Nichols, okay. I think it's called A Life. And just the way he lays out a person's artistic life story and balances it with their personal story. And he did that, another one called, was it Pictures at a Revolution? Is that the film one? It's about five films that happened in this one year that were the dawn of a new cinema in America. And his books are just so, they're just so inspiring, because he does his reporting, you know, he gets in there but it's human, you know, it's not just dry facts. And that's inspiring to me as a guy who writes biographies. So,
yeah, cool. All right. Well, Paul, thank you for answering those questions. We're going to take a short break, and then we will continue digging deep with Paul Myers. We're just going to take a quick break so I can tell you a little bit more about the presenting sponsor of Digging Deep, ZenBooks. ZenBooks is Canada's go-to cloud accounting firm. They are not your typical accounting firm. I know the founders, Colin and Eric. I've worked with them for several years. And here's why I think you should consider working with them too. First of all, they bring a fresh, unique, modern approach to what is a very old-fashioned industry. These guys were working remotely and in the cloud long before it became cool. ZenBooks also uses technology to your advantage. I think this is really important. They give you the tools and analysis you need to monitor your business in real time. That's so valuable right now when everything changes so quickly. Yes, they're a virtual accounting firm, but that doesn't mean they're offshore, and it doesn't mean they're inattentive. ZenBooks combines the efficiency and effectiveness of a cloud accounting service with all the benefits that you'd want from a trusted advisor, high-level advice, and strategic support. Now, here's what I think is going to happen if you work with ZenBooks. You'll probably start out taking advantage of their cutting-edge cloud accounting solutions, but in the long run, I think you'll stay with them because of their strategic guidance and problem solving. Among their core values, they specifically list being candid and proactive. Isn't that exactly what you want from a trusted advisor? Look, even if you're already working with an accountant or a bookkeeper, or you have some accounting staff on your team, I think you should still talk to ZenBooks and learn more about their tools and their expertise. Check out ZenBooks at zenbooks.ca. That's zenbooks.ca. Digging Deep is all about helping you make better decisions, and so is Abacus Data. Most leaders struggle to connect with and engage their audiences. Why is that? It's because they aren't sure how they think and feel and how they will react. Abacus Data can give you the strategic insights you need to make better decisions and to make them confidently. Here's a good example. A major national union was recently negotiating a new agreement for its thousands of members. This had the potential to be a very difficult process. There were many competing interests. So they brought in Abacus Data to conduct thorough and detailed research of their members to learn exactly where they stood, what they were thinking, what they wanted. And as a result, they were able to secure a strong new deal that was accepted overwhelmingly in a national vote. Abacus Data helps all of its clients understand what's really happening in the minds of their employees, clients, and stakeholders. They help them avoid costly blind spots. And they're really good at what they do. In fact, Abacus Data was one of the most accurate pollsters in the 2019 Canadian federal election. Make the one decision that will improve all of your other decisions. Let Abacus Data help you move forward with confidence and clarity. Go to abacusdata.ca. That's abacusdata.ca. So, Paul, thank you once again for joining me today. This has already been so much fun, and there's a bunch of things that I want to drill into that we've already talked about and much more as well. But I understand you once got to play Taking Care of Business on stage with Randy Bachman. Is that true?
Yeah. How much of the story do you want to hear? Because I'll tell you
all
everything.
Of it, please.
Okay. So I mentioned when I moved to Vancouver, it changed my life in a lot of ways. I was on a weekly cable TV show. I was on a national show, the Vicky Gabbro show, doing music, cultural thing, reporting on her show. And I was writing for the Georgia Strait, but I also got this radio show on, it's kind of an embarrassing channel to be on. I was on, their format was talk radio for guys, which is already stupid, but they had offered me 2 hours a day to be on the show, just being the kind of guy that I am. I mean, I'm not a beef and booze guy, you know, but by then I was also recovering, so I wasn't even a booze guy. So, but what I said was, if I can be the kind of dude that I am, which is a culture guy, I'll do this show. And it was fun. So I got to do all this stuff, and I would have some of my heroes on. And Randy Bachman lives in the West Coast, and through various, something he was doing, a one-man show where he tells the story of his life through his songs, you know? And it was pretty good, actually. It was a really good show. And so we had him on as a phone guest. He was supposed to do a half hour with me. I told him how I had a Bachman Turner Overdrive album when I was 13. And I bought it in England, and my English auntie didn't like that I bought a Canadian rock and roll record while I was in England. She thought I should have bought an English record, all this stuff. He loves the stories. He loves hearing that, you know, the effect it had. And I said, you know, my band used to do a version of Taking Care of Business in my band in Toronto. where we would break into a Run DMC style breakdown. You know, we get up every morning from the alarm clock warning. And it was like, it was a really kind of a hit of our, you know, when we did a cover, it was a fun thing to do. And I would do the little scratching sound of a vinyl scratch, but on my pick against the guitar string. So, you know, it was really cool. And he was delighted by that. And we were having a great time. And the half hour was coming up and it was like commercial radio. So we had a hard break, you know, so I had to, yeah. I said, Randy, I would love to keep talking to you. I think we had one commercial and I said, this is going so well. Do you think you could do longer than a half an hour? And so when we go off the neck and he said, sure, man, let's just do it. So he stayed for a whole hour and we had the most amazing chat. By the end of it, he says to me, you should come to the gig we're doing at what's it called? It's in Stanley Park. It's like the band shell there. Why can't I remember? The Malcolm Bowl, I think it's called.
Okay. And, yeah. I know the band shell. I don't know what it's called. Yeah.
Yeah. And he said, come to the show and bring your guitar. And I said, well, are you serious? And he said, yeah, yeah. So, you know, so it's an outdoor show. He says, and come early so that you can plug your guitar in and, you know, join us for the soundtrack. I'm like, really? So I show up and I think he said, I didn't bring my guitar. I just thought, oh no, he was just saying that. So I get right there and he says, do you have your guitar? And I said, well, I was hoping I could use one of yours. And he says, well, I'd rather you bring your, how far away do you live? And luckily I lived, you know, not that far. And I ran home and got my guitar and we did the sound check. And and then the show, and then they, you know, he does the whole show, and then he says, I want to have a special guest up. This is Paul Myers, blah blah blah. And we come up and we do Taking Care of Business, we do the normal version, and then we do the breakdown version, which is the hip hop version, and you know, it goes over really well. And then so we're playing Taking Care of Business, and like he even let me solo, you know, like he let me take a solo. He took one, he's Randy Bachman, and then I took one, and it was like whatever. You know, but I remember thinking you'll never get this chance again. And I wore a faded blue denim jacket that day. And it reminded me of the kind of thing I wore when I was a teenager in Toronto, you know? So I remember sort of feeling like I understood the life circle of this thing, you know? And then it culminated with him inviting Lisa and I to Salt Spring Island for, he was getting remarried to his wife who he'd been separated from. And having like a family wedding with a few guests, like someone from Chilliwack and various people, and Tom Hooper from the Grapes of Wrath and his partner, and it was just very weird to be sort of part of their family event, you know. But and I got to see the Gretsch vault, which he has a collection of Gretsch guitars that he keeps in a climate controlled bunker, basically, you know. And so that was kind of a mind-blowing thing. But getting to play those, you know, especially that, you know, the Taking Care of Business is three chords, you know, three chords in The Truth, man. But it's like, you know, it just, and like, how could you get it wrong? You know, it was really fun.
Incredible. And so, you know, now I feel self-conscious about every interview I do, if it doesn't culminate with such a deep connection with the person that I'm invited to the renewal of their vows or their next wedding, right? Like it was obviously a really, you did a great job with that interview, making that connection with him, because it led to all kinds of things.
Well, thank you. And you know, it's funny because now I host a podcast and I talk to people all the time, and I do connect with some people. And but so far I haven't been invited to anyone's wedding.
So just Randy Bachman.
Yes.
Now, having said all of that, is it true you also had a lot of Carpenters records when you were a kid?
Yes. Where was that listed? It's amazing. Yeah.
I heard you talking about that on a podcast.
Well, yeah. So we had like, so you know, I used to take a lot of lumps for liking things that were like not I guess not macho things or whatever. One of the things was I loved ABBA and I loved the Carpenters and I loved 10cc and like 10cc's I'm Not in Love, which is like real, you know, real like boohoo song. At the same time, I loved it. And I was really in touch with that. But the Carpenters, the minute I heard Close to You, you know, I later realized that it was Burt Bacharach's song, and that's, you know, Burt Bacharach is just, you know, one of the greatest composers, and he has a way with turning chords and melodies that just tug at my heart. And the arrangement was really great. But, you know, hearing Karen Carpenter's layered vocals and, you know, just the way she overdubbed herself, and Richard was in there too. And it just, and that, so that was great. And then I bought a lot of singles, basically. I never bought albums, but I would bought, but the other one I really remember is Hurting Each Other, which was another, we go on hurting each other.
Oh yeah.
Making each other cry. There you go. You got a free Karen Carpenter tour there. I'm the kind of kid who loved, you know, Tin Soldiers and Nixon Coming at the same time as liking Karen Carpenter.
Sure.
You know,
but that's, I mean, you had eclectic taste. You obviously comfortable with that. And that's what spawned your sort of, you know, that's what led to your whole career, which I think is great. And speaking of your childhood, obviously you grew up in a very creative household, I'm imagining. Can you describe what that was like, what your family life was like?
Yeah, my parents were, my father was an amateur actor who decided to get a straight job and became an insurance salesman, but had a real deep love of the arts, specifically comedy and jazz. And so those are the two things I remember most around the house were like The Goon Show and Peter Sellers and things like that. And also Django Reinhardt music. And he also liked Spike Jonze, the band leader. Who used comedy sound effects, you know? And so there was a lot of that sense in our house. My dad loved Bugs Bunny, you know, because it combined all those elements, classical music, sound effects, and comedy, you know, and talking rabbits, let's be honest. and then my mother was also an actress who didn't follow through on it, but made a very big, she valued being an actor and making things. And, you know, and also when I wrote a poem in grade four, she was really supportive of it. Like she really said, this is a good thing. She made it a virtue. She said it was a virtue, like to be an artist is to be a virtue, you know? So that's a really, you know, smart thing to tell a kid. And, you know, and the fact that they had both unrealized dreams, I think weighed on all three of my brothers, Peter, Mike, and me.
Yeah. And that's really interesting because I think there is an instinct in parents to, I don't want to say drum that out of kids, but to, you know, there's an instinct sometimes to say, well, I want to make sure my kids are set up for life and they have real jobs and you're not gonna, you know, they're not going to make any money writing poems. So, so it better that they, you know, go to university and become a lawyer than be a poet. Cause that's a more stable life. But it doesn't sound like that's the feedback you got from your parents or that either of your brothers did.
Yeah, no, they didn't. Yeah. If anything, the only thing that my parents didn't do, I think, is they didn't really instill a sense of money-making and taking responsibility for your life that I think all three of us, my brothers, when we met our partners, these poor women had to basically train us, you know, to do basic life skills, because we had such a liberal arts background that we made a conscious decision not to have kids, but I know my brother Mike has kids and my brother Peter has kids and he has one kid and they, you know, they probably have a different approach to being a parent than we had, from our parents. So I think you do learn, you know, and, you know, things have changed too. Times have changed. My parents grew up and my parents are really, they're both passed away, but they were both in World War II as, you know, young people, but, you know, they didn't, and they were English and they knew nothing of modern psychology. You know, they knew nothing of, you know, I had undiagnosed ADHD that it took me till my 30s to figure out, you know, so they never figured out what they had. So, you know, that's a whole different mindset.
Well, I mentioned, you know, my dad grew up in Yorkshire in the north of England. Your parents are from Liverpool, right?
That's right.
So, you know, and I think there's growing up in the time of the Second World War, being a child in that time, and then there's being a child in that time in Europe or in England, like that, you know, that's... There's bombs, you know, you're not watching from a distance. So I'm sure that shapes things. So do you think like, what do you think that creativity and that sort of connection to the arts? Is that genetic? Is it environmental? You know, because what would you say about that?
I nature, nurture. I don't know. Recently I had Mike McCartney on my show.
I heard that.
And I connect with him. I felt this before. We've emailed a few times and texted and Twitter too. And I just feel like I understand what's called the Scouser way, the Liverpudlian sense of humor, Liverpudlian sense of the importance of making cultural things, you know. Yeah. When I say cultural things, I use a lowercase c, by the way. I'm not pretentious about using words like I'm an artist or culture person or something like that. To me, it's just what my values are. It's the same as saying I'm into sports. It doesn't make you an athlete necessarily. I really appreciate culture. And I think Liverpudlians that I've met and that I've talked about and, you know, read, obviously we're all living in the shadow of the Beatles still, who were, you know, great exports. But I mean, later on, I loved Echo and the Bunnymen from Liverpool and Frankie Goes to Hollywood from Liverpool. And so it's there's definitely something's in the water and some of it's drinkable, but, you know, the Mersey River, you know, the mighty Mersey. My dad's ashes are scattered in the Mersey River, by the way, just so you know.
Okay. Well, wow. Yeah. So I heard your interview with Mike McCartney, Paul's brother. You know, it's funny, the whole Liverpool thing, because you were talking to him about Liverpool, because he has a book of photographs of Liverpool. And I remember the first time I went to Liverpool, and there was, I wish I could remember the exact wording of it or that I'd taken a picture, but there was some, Liverpool's been through a lot of ups and downs, obviously, as many industrial cities in England have. And there was some billboard or sign or something when you first drove into Liverpool, the time I went for the first time. And it was almost like, I'm paraphrasing, but it was almost like, Liverpool, it can't get any worse. It's only up from here or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, you just know that, you know, so many of the people there have been through so much, but
Just to buttonhole that, Paul McCartney sings, I got to admit, it's getting better all the time. And then John sings, it couldn't get much worse.
Right.
You know? So there's definitely, you know, if that's not Liverpool in a couplet, what is, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So how did your relationship with music start? And why do you think we do have this connection with music? I find it interesting that there, you know, we all love music. We all love books. We all love movies. You know, there's so many different, we might love theater, but we're much more likely to listen to the same song hundreds of times than we are to even watch the same movie twice or read the same book twice. Right. So there's obviously something deep about music.
Well, I don't know. I'm not even sure if I've ever, believe it or not, thought about the why. All I know is that from a very early age, music travels through the air. But it goes into your heart and your mind, right? So, and music can do things like a chord shift for me. Like when the strings come in on the second verse of Walk On By, the Dionne Warwick recording, Burt Bacharach, and this raft of strings just comes in on like a single note, but it's creeping in. And to me, it reminds me of when you're about to cry and you feel that tingle in your nose, right? There's that thing of like, I'm about to lose it. And the strings totally do that, because this is a woman saying, you know, you see me walking down the street and I start to cry, and she's saying, walk on by. It's a person trying to control their emotions in public. And all of a sudden these strings are creeping in, almost like saying, you can't escape us. So that was a musical story. That's not even in the lyrics, you know? And to me, that's amazing. Like that is, you know, and McCartney's done it too on various occasions, just a change in a chord. Bacharach does it all the time. And that's just popular music. I mean, when I discovered like Stravinsky and things, and that stuff's rock and roll, man. Like there's like, you know, jagged things happening, and, you know, and music can do so much more without saying a word, you know?
Yeah.
So I don't know.
And no movie would be the same without music, right? I mean, that so where did that relationship begin for you? And when did you discover, like, I'm into this at a level that, you know, other people are listening to songs, but I'm really into music?
Yeah. I'd like to think, well, I had an AM radio as a kid, and I think, but what got me listening to that? I mean, it must have been seeing the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show. I'm that old. And I was a real kid, little kid though. I mean, it was maybe that's even more important. That is, I might have been pre-verbal. No, I wasn't pre-verbal, but I was definitely, it's early on in my teaching and socialization. I something about the way the chords in She Loves You and the euphoria, the instant euphoria of She Loves You. And there's that, I could probably, someone could explain it musically, but that the glang, 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 the way that happens on that E minor chord, and I think it's an E minor chord. And there's a certain tension there that's telling a whole story. It's its own thing. And then there's Ringo, the drums leading into it. And then the way they're all screaming in unison, she loves you. And it's insistent. And that made me realize that music is this big thing. And it certainly didn't hurt that there was girls liking it. Like it probably impressed me that it was something that if you had an aptitude for it, you might actually be the person on stage. And so music was could be a participation sport for me. I didn't have to just be a spectator. So whereas maybe I didn't feel that way about watching the javelin thrower, you know?
Right. Yeah.
God, the world would have been so different if only I'd picked up a javelin. But anyway.
What's the secret to writing a song? Because you've written songs and you've written about songwriters. And this is something that has always been a mystery to me. You just talked about some of the ingredients in one particular song, but do people set out to do that with a song, or does it just happen and then you can explain the magic of it afterwards?
Oh, well, this goes back to the 10,000 hours thing. I think from what I understand, songwriting is butterfly catching, but it's more than that. It's butterfly catching, but you have to have an eye for it. You have to know which butterfly to chase, and you have to have the right net, and you have to know what to do when you get it. Now, the difference is you're now then taking the butterfly and perhaps dressing the butterfly and mounting the butterfly in a frame, which is sounds horrible because you're killing the butterfly. But let's say that's a living frame. And so chasing inspiration, and then so you become adept, I think. A songwriter is probably someone who's adept at having walked through what good chords can do for them and walked through their instrument or walked through listening to other people play, because some songwriters don't even play that well, but they know what they want the guitar player to play. They know what they want. They can tell a piano player play like this. And, you know, so then there's the lyrics, and so sometimes people can't do both, and they have Elton John and Bernie Taupin, and you have, you know, Hal David and Burt Bacharach. And so sometimes it's knowing, having an aptitude and an inspiration to know, you've had favorite lyrics that you've heard and you go, how could I do that? You listen to Bob Dylan and you go, he's writing is about first person things, and he's not saying, baby, I love you. He's writing about society. Well, maybe I should try that. Or maybe the opposite. Maybe you heard Paul McCartney saying it's okay to have silly love songs. And you go, I have that feeling. I could write one of those. And so maybe, you know, and that, so I feel like I could only speak for myself and know that it's just about wearing, if you call it like a suit, wearing all those materials so much that you know kind of how to make a suit.
Right.
You know, you kind of know how to cut, you know, what's like Project Runway. So you sort of know how to make a really nice pant that goes with that jacket.
Yeah.
You know,
that's a good explanation for it.
That's the right answer.
Yeah. And I think, and I'm sure you would agree, that there's this really deep connection between music and our memory. And I'll give you an example. I lost my sister almost 20 years ago, but I remember the music that my sister listened to when we were kids. So as an example, she's, I think, do you remember the Columbia record club, like, you know, where you'd, you'd order like whatever, 10, 12 records for a buck. And then
I signed up. I was a member.
Yeah. My sister had that. And I think she's the only person who ever beat the system. Like, she figured out how to do it so that they didn't end up getting more of her money than they, than she wanted. But she ended up with a bunch of music, and she would play this music. And one of the bands she was really into at a particular moment in time was the Alan Parsons Project.
Right.
And so I realized, like, if I put on a song by the Alan Parsons Project, like, I'm immediately transported back to that time, and all these memories come flooding out that I would not be able to access without the song playing. There's something, right. You know, there's just something about music and our memory, I think.
I think you're right. My condolences on your loss, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
Just want to say that. Yeah. And I would ask you, actually, because I'm fascinated with this. Is there a bittersweet emotion that comes with hearing the Alan Parsons Project now for you?
Absolutely. Yeah.
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 I can imagine. I know this happens to me too. And there, I guess it's,
to give you an example, Paul, like, yeah, I'm telling you this story. I haven't really told anybody else about it, because just in the last few months I've been listening to, and I will only do that when I'm alone. Right. So I'm alone in the car, or I'm something like that. That's the only time that I've played any Alan Parsons Project.
Wow. Yeah.
So that's deep, a deliberate choice, right? So
yeah, it's deep. No, I will weep at various music that, you know, represents a certain period of my life that might've been either a joyful memory, or sometimes it can be, as they say, triggering, you know. And I guess I wouldn't tell anyone what to do, but I'd say there is some joy to that, to know that is feeling something intense doesn't mean it's bad. It's obviously a sad memory, but at the same time, I guess knowing that you can still feel is a really good thing. You know?
Yeah.
Because you're in touch with it, you know?
Yeah.
It can't hurt you if you're in touch with it. You know, it's only
that's a great point. And I don't actually consider it a sad thing, because there's certainly a sad element to it, but it's reconnecting me with my sister and with that time in our lives. Right.
Yeah,
so,
right.
Yeah. It's like looking at old pictures, you know, but I think it's deeper than that. It's more visceral than that for some reason, because of what music does.
I absolutely agree. And I just to bring it back to the standard question, which was, definitely. Music has an ability to hang itself on your inner story, you know, like it becomes coded with all your emotional memory. So it's a great thing though, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I wonder if flavors do that. You know, I wonder if the first time you ever had barbecued spare ribs or something, you know, if it was the best Christmas ever, then you'll always remember that, you know, like for me, obviously eggnog and cinnamon drinks and things like that remind me of Christmas's past, you know. And anyway, yeah, so that's an interesting area.
Yeah, we all have our soundtracks, right? The soundtracks of our lives. So I've been asking you to, you know, because of your deep knowledge and passion for music, I've been hitting you with all these long-standing questions that I've had about how music works and all of that. But I do want to talk more about your own career and experiences. And I'm interested in the selection of books that you've written and how you've chosen what to write about. And I get this sense that when you write, and this ties into what we've just been talking about with music, that it's, you're not just writing about the subjects, but you're kind of writing about your experience with those subjects too, that there's something autobiographical in a way about even when you're writing about somebody else, that there's that connection there.
I will say that, and thank you for picking up on that. I will say that there was something that, some advice that I got from one from a therapist and one from another writer, which was, you know, find a way to bring, you can't do it unless you bring yourself to it. It's too hard to do. And sometimes for some projects, it's been a while for me to figure out, once I started doing it, I thought, well, what am I bringing to this? Like, cause you don't want to be too literal with that. The first book I wrote was the Bare Naked Ladies biography, and that's the group. And they asked me, because they knew me, they knew I'd become a writer and I'd been on the music scene with them. And they asked me to write, to be their point person, basically, for what was ostensibly an autobiography written by someone else. So the idea was that I would get their stories together and I would write the story from inside the tent.
Right.
And
the authorized.
It's an authorized biography. Yeah. And I was hired by their management company to do it. And they were paid by their publisher. And
is it true you met them at Alcatraz, by the way? Is that?
Well, I didn't meet them first time there.
Okay.
I mean, but to talk about the book, I did. Yeah.
Okay.
So I was living in San Francisco by then. I had been on the Toronto music scene with them and we all knew each other. In fact, they opened for my band, the Gravelberries. And then the next time we were on a bill together, it was reversed.
Right. Yeah.
They shot past everybody. And
they
were trending
in a different direction.
They were like bundles of energy, those guys.
Yeah.
They were young, creative, and you know, they were like Hamilton, Alexander Hamilton. Like they were young, hungry, and you know, and thirsty, and all they were just going for it. And so, but anyway, but the thing was, we all stayed friends because they're good guys, and they knew that they had come into the scene and made friends with everybody, and everybody was so happy for their success as a result. So when I was down in San Francisco, I'd only been there a couple of years, and they happened to be there, and Tyler called me up and said, come see us. You know, we're doing this press event in Alcatraz for our new album, but it's going to be a big album because Warner's put us on their list of bands that they want to break this year in America, which is huge. That's the year that they put out 1 week, the single, you know? So it hadn't come out yet. And he says, you should come to the hotel, hear the record. I'll play it for you on a CD. And then we'll go to Alcatraz and we'll meet everybody. And we want to ask you something. And what they wanted to ask me was whether I would write their biography. And I was like, wow. So part of this was going on a ferry out to Alcatraz Island. Stevie Nicks was there, Chris Isaac, Alan Jackson, the country singer, Tina Marie, who's an artist from, I think, Europe. Yeah. And they're all
way back. Yeah.
And talk about tacky, though, because Alcatraz is a museum. Built in a federal prison on an island that was stolen from Native Americans. So there's a lot of bad history on Alcatraz, right? But it's also a beautiful place in its own weird way. Well, to do this, I guess they rented this out, and Warner Brothers had this thing where they had the press were going from cell to cell to meet all the artists, which is like really crazy. It's like you have like Stevie Nicks in a jail cell and she's there to do press outreach to meet the president of Warehouse Records in the United States or something, or the buyers.
I'd love to be there for the conversation when they told Stevie Nicks that plan, right?
We're gonna stick
you in a jail cell in Alcatraz and people are gonna come through one by one to meet with you.
Yeah, I can only imagine, like, I got someone like Johnny Cash would say, are you sure about this?
Yeah.
You know, but it was wild. And then by the end of it, I said, well, you know, let's talk about, you know, contract. And, you know, I hadn't ever done a book before, so I didn't even know how to start. And, you know, it all worked out eventually. It was a pretty weird year, but, you know, and that was weird too, because Kevin Hearn wasn't there. And it turned out that the reason he wasn't there is he wasn't feeling well. And then by the time I signed on to do the book, it was, oh, Kevin's got cancer, and this book is going to be kind of important because it's about everything that led up to this year as well. And so there was a real sense, and I couldn't interview him because he was in the middle of chemo, so I couldn't do the interviews for him. And I ended up I had written a bio for him for a solo record he'd done because I knew him, and he's still alive, by the way. He's healthy and happy right now. But I had this bio. It was like a 10 pages of notes. So a lot of the stuff about Kevin in the book was from this interview I'd done like the year before, which was crazy if you think about the happenstance of that. And then I just did interviews with every one of them. And then we just did several drafts, and then that was it. So that came out of that. But the thing about bringing yourself to it, sorry.
Yeah.
So they said, we'd like you to do this because you're from our scene and you understand us. And we'd like you to be, talk about who you are in the book and speak in the first person when you want. So I now regret it because I did. And I learned, you don't do that. It was just too much. It was like, I was talking about my band. I was talking about, you know, what it was like for me. you know, you're a fan of the Bare Naked Ladies and you pick up this book, you know, you just want to hear their story. You don't want to hear Paul Myers, you know? I mean, you know, let's be honest, there's probably one in a million people who go, I like the part about Paul Myers, but they didn't come for it, you know? So it's a harder sell to do that. On another book, the Kids in the Hall book, which is a few books later, I lived a lot of that story because they were contemporaries of mine and I hung out in their scene and knew them when they were starting out. And my brother, Mike, the comedian, had been involved with them professionally and had a similar rise to fame. So I put that in the foreword of the book so that you could get that out of the way, because I didn't want to be a narrative character in the narrative, but I thought it was kind of fascinating as a way of saying I have the, what do they call it? Bona fides. Is that how you pronounce it? But yeah. I had the authenticity of being there. So you could say that this story is an insider story rather than also as a way of mea culpa, maybe if I'm too sympathetic to them, I'm not writing a hatchet book. I'm not writing a hit job. So I wanted to be, I thought it was kind of honest to put myself in it, but I wanted to put myself in it only at the beginning. So we get that out of the way, you know?
Yeah.
So sometimes Long John Baldry, another book I wrote called It Ain't Easy, Long John Baldry and the Birth of the British Blues. The publisher, Greystone, asked me, I pitched another book to him and he said, that's good. What do you know about Long John Baldry? And Long John Baldry had just died in Vancouver. He was a British rock star from the 60s and 70s and had some, he'd moved to Canada in the 80s and had some moderate hits in Canada, was well regarded and beloved. He passed away around 95, I think it was, and top of my head. And it was a story in Vancouver that he had been a kind of a Vancouver rock star, in-house rock star from England who had been a Vancouver fixture. And so the publisher was kind of saying to me, this guy is an interesting story for us as a Vancouver-based publisher. And what would you do? And I wasn't that huge a Long John Baldry fan. Like, I knew his stuff and I knew several things about him, about his history. And I said to Rob Sanders, the publisher, and I said, if I could make this book about the British blues movement that spawned the Rolling Stones, Led Zeppelin, Jeff Beck, Yardbirds, all that stuff. And also the fact that Elton John wrote Someone Saved My Life Tonight. Well, Bernie Taupin wrote the lyrics based on a story that had happened where John Baldry saved his life, because John Baldry was a gay man and was kind of inside out. You know, he was out to his friends and he told Elton John, you know, you're actually a gay man. You should just accept it instead of committing suicide. And it saved his life. And, you know, and I told Rob this whole story and I said, and, you know, he also discovered Rod Stewart. You know, he brought Rod Stewart into his band and Rod Stewart wouldn't have had a career at that moment unless it was with John Baldry. And he said, wow, that's amazing. I said, so if I could tell the story of John Baldry as the conduit to all this British blues music that got exported back to the United States, then I think I could do this because that's the story I'm interested in. So that's an example of bringing yourself to something.
Yeah, right? That's like, great. Yeah.
So that gave me the fuel for those days and nights of tracking different people. And I'll never forget, you know, Elton John on the line, waiting on the line in terms of like fishing, waiting. They say he might do an interview. All of a sudden, we had just moved back to San Francisco in 90. I can't remember the story now, but all I remember is getting the story and all of a sudden getting a call. Elton will call you in 5 minutes.
So you're waiting to get an interview with Elton John.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden somebody says like, you're going to get the call in 5 minutes. Not he's going to talk to you tomorrow or the next day.
Yeah. Or next Thursday. Yeah. So I didn't have an iPhone in those days, so I didn't record it off the thing, but I had a recording device that I grabbed and I held it to the phone.
Right.
And it was that crude. And I've listened to that tape recently because I made an MP3 of it. And it's just like, and it's like, I did my best to record it off the phone, but it was just like nightmare, you know, and you can hear the mic jostling every so often because it wasn't even a solid hookup. It was just my hand holding it and just thinking, how long do I get? Because you never know, because they might get called away, know, and then Rod Stewart also did an interview. Paul McCartney sent an email about John Baldry, which was as good as an interview. And that was the other thing that taught me too. That book was a great book because for me, because I got to get those people and I learned about, you know, tracking to get all the names to come in and talk to you, you know, and that thing of having a chart, which I actually have one in the background. You can't really see it from here, but I'm working on a project now and I have like lists of names of people that you have to have, you know, and I have folders with like, you know, this person for that story. And you start crossing them off and it starts to feel good because, you know, you get, you know, like, it's neat. And then,
so because the people you want to interview for the book and then how are you going to get to them? Right.
Yeah. And some people you have them, you set, you have them on the line and, so to speak, they're ready to go. And then someone says, their schedule's changed. Can you call back? Can we try this next month? And you start to learn that there's a way when people are just deferring to ultimately cancel, they'll say, can we revisit this later? And that's like, that means never.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you learn to say things like, can we get something on the books then? Well, let's reschedule, but let's say January 3rd, you know, and they go, oh, well, why don't you call me on January 1st, which means we're still going to cancel. But, you know, but we're going to let you, we're going to let you wait through Christmas to find out. But anyway, that's, and that's the detective part of the job. By the way, that's the part that destroys me sometimes because I have become a perfectionist to the point where I really want to get everybody on my list. And I've actually done pretty good. You know, I'm actually pretty proud of the Todd Rundgren book I did. I got pretty much 98% of the names on my list, including Patti Smith. You know, to talk to me about Elton John, about to talk to me about Todd Rundgren. Sorry.
Yeah.
Elton John. But Elton John was the one that was the one for the Baldry book was like, I couldn't believe I finally got Elton, you know?
No kidding. And is your next book going to be about John Candy? Is that right?
That's right. And this is an example. There's been a long period of me trying to figure out what it is I liked about my last books was all, you know, that I knew where I fit into it. And I'm writing this book about John Candy and it's somebody I don't know. I didn't know him at all. And I never met him. And I feel like it's taken me a while and I'm only now just getting to the point where I just from doing so many interviews that I now know kind of where I'm going with this. But right now, I mean, I've got Catherine O'Hara, Steve Martin, Martin Short, Dan Aykroyd, you know, all these directors that worked with him, Ron Howard,
right.
You know, yeah. And, you
can't
know,
wait to see that. Yeah.
So it's,
and I,
it, should... and he's a big character in all our lives too. I mean, cause John Candy was one of the first big Canadian comedian stars, you know,
Uncle Buck, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
Oh, still a classic, and he was great in everything. Even if the movie wasn't great, John Candy was great. You know, you never look away from John Candy when he's on screen.
Yeah. And, you know, I've been focusing on the music and your relationship with music, but I think you're equally fascinated by comedy. And of course you wrote about Kids in the Hall and, and so that's a big part of your life too, right?
Oh yeah. You know, coming to terms with comedy has been a real, cause my brother obviously is, you know, very established in comedy. So I kind of backed away from comedy early on, but I took Second City workshops and I've had such an arm's length relationship with comedy that I now think of myself as a comedy aficionado to the point where a new sketch troupe will emerge and I'll know exactly what's good about them or not good about them.
Yeah.
And it's as interesting to me as music. So I feel like that's a thing.
Yeah. So when I hear you talk about all of this and the projects you work on and how much you absorb yourself in them, you know, I feel like it's a labor of love and you're getting paid to do some things that you would probably love to do anyway, even if you weren't getting paid. Is that, which I think is great. I think that's the ultimate aspiration professionally. Does this even feel like, I'm sure there's parts of it that do, but does this even feel like work for you?
Yes.
It does. Okay.
It does. And it, unfortunately, you mentioned about getting paid. I would love it to pay more. Because, you know, for every thing you do, it's wildly inconsistent in terms of, it's not a straight life and, you know, it can definitely weigh on you. You know, the freelance life is not, it's not for the faint of heart. And there's a trade-off. I do get to do stuff about stuff I love. I guess that's the trade-off, but I wish it wasn't the way. And you always travel optimistically that maybe somewhere around the corner, you're going to get a gig that's like, you know, worth your time. So,
yeah. So I just want to drill down on a couple of other things you brought up earlier. You mentioned new experiences you've had in the last year. So we can talk about that in a second, but you did mention that you've been sober for some time now. I think it's been more than 22 or 23 years. Do you talk a lot about that?
I talk about it with people who might need to hear it. In 1997, I decided that alcohol wasn't working for me. So, I kind of came to that after several times of thinking that. And then it was a kind of a beautiful moment where I think it was Lisa who asked me, like, what would it be like if you didn't drink at all? And I started crying. And I said, I started laughing because that's my sense of humor. I went, oh my God, what a character. Like, what a pathetic, funny moment this is. Like, and then it was truly funny. It was like, you're crying over something that's just not like a loss of a human or a pet, you know? And so then I thought, okay, I'm going to just try this for one day and 2 days. And then you start getting on a streak and you think, well, I don't want to blow the streak. You know, the joke we were making at every Christmas for the first 10 years was, well, you proved your point. You know, like, I guess I proved my point. I can start drinking again.
Yeah.
But I got to say, it's talk about secret power or whatever. Whenever I feel like I'm not achieving or I can't change or whatever, I just think, wow, you did that, you know?
Yeah.
And it is kind of an example of, and so people do come to me, like, cause I'm open about it. People on the internet who I don't even know will say, you know, I just quit drinking 3 weeks ago and, you know, I know it's not much. And I'll say, keep going. It's really good that you did this. Or people ask me, Paul, how did you do it? And I'll just tell them what I did and see if they can do it for themselves. And, you know, just it's what you do. You did. And I've had people tell me when I was questioning before I decided to quit, you know, and I don't tell anyone how to live, but I know that if you're asking the question, chances are you're already there, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point. So what is it about the last year that has brought on so many new and interesting experiences?
Well, a couple of things happened. Like the Kids in the Hall book, got interest in other media. So that's cool. And then that's drawn me into this world of documentaries. And so there's a lot of things on the go there. And also, to be frank, I worked on a TV series with my brother, which I never do. And that got me to go to England. And so that was kind of neat, like just to be part of essentially a comedy series, basically like making a movie, and to be embedded, like, I guess my journalist skills were kind of primed because I had a role within the company, but I was there every day watching everyone else do their thing. And it was just really, you know, hugely fun to be on the payroll in London, in an apartment that was paid for, which is, you know, coming on the heels of the worst of the pandemic, hopefully the worst of the pandemic. The 2020 year was horrible. So in 2021, to be able to get to London safely and work in a COVID safe set where you're being tested every day, with people wearing masks when they're not working, and just that sense of it was a safe way to do this thing, which I didn't know if I'd ever get to travel again. And if you'd asked me in March 2020 if I could have gone to England again, I don't think I would have known how that was going to happen. So just to do that and to be, you know, witnessing, watching really some amazing comedians and actors do their thing and crew people doing their thing and cinematographers and lighting people and set designers and just, you know, and the catering, oh my God, the catering. So just working in film too, kind of opened me up to something too, which is just really, yet another new thing that I can add to the list of weird things that I didn't think I'd be doing when I wanted to just be a rock star as a kid.
Yeah. So the last thing I wanted to ask you about, and I'm, I, had intended to spend more time on this, but we just ended up talking about a lot of other stuff, and that's your podcast. I've become a fan of the podcast and really enjoy the conversations that you're sharing there with a really eclectic mix of people. What's that experience been like for you, and what have you learned from getting to talk to all these really interesting folks?
Well, thank you for enjoying the podcast. That's the Record Store Day podcast. And the Record Store Day podcast was because I for a long time, having done broadcasting before, like I said, in Vancouver and stuff, I really like the medium. I really like, I learned that I know how to do what you're hearing right now, I guess, is being me on microphone. And I was talking to one of the bosses at Record Store Day because they hired me to write liner notes for one of their Record Store Day reissues. Right. And I said, you know, I want to do a podcast. And I just mentioned it. And he said, why don't you do one for us? And I said, well, do you guys have a podcast? And he said, well, no, you would start it. What would you need to start it? And I said, well,
I just want to double click there on Record Store Day, because that's for those people who don't know, this is kind of a really cool thing that is about releasing limited edition vinyl and reestablishing the role of record stores, right?
Physical media, as they say. So what they do is they're an organization. It started with that there was an actual Record Store Day in April, where independent record stores and some chain record stores, but mostly independent record stores, they would have these products that they could sell through the Record Store Day company that were exclusives for only to be sold on that one day. And then they started having two or three different record store days a year. They have RSD's Black Friday, which is after American Thanksgiving. And so then they just became like a full-time thing where they're basically like a guild or a merchants association for record stores and promoting the culture of record stores. So for them to have a podcast was a great idea, but also because the podcast that I sort of designed for them was the thing I wanted to do, this, that thing about bringing yourself to it. I thought, well, I want to talk to musicians and people who are in the music business and producers and album cover artists and photographers who take music photographs. I want to do that. I want to have those conversations and have those conversations and just record them, you know, and just listen as much as I talk, hopefully, or less. Listen more than I talk. Sorry. And in this case, you're asking me questions, so I'm telling you a lot. But
I was going to ask you if it felt
I'm on the other side of the gun. I'm on the other side of the game. Yeah.
Yeah. You're not normally in that chair, right?
If I talk this much in my own interviews, like when I'm interviewing somebody, then I'm making a mistake, you know? Yeah. So this was one of those things where it worked out really well. And, you know, I do things like I'll interview record store operators as part of the show, because that is, you know, our raison d'etre, you know, like we're there to promote record stores. But at the same time, you know, I'll just go off and talk to, you know, Mike McCartney about his photography book, and it's related to music because he's a musician, and The Scaffold and McGear were great records. But, you know, we know what that is. That's me wanting to talk about something that I'm interested in.
Yeah.
And, you know, hopefully if you've been listening to the show, and it sounds like you have, you know, a lot of times me being interested is enough to get it going, because then they hear that I'm interested and the subject starts talking, and then you get a good story out of them.
Yeah. And I think that's the beautiful thing about our time, the internet, podcasts, you know, blogs, all of that stuff, because I think there was before that all of this creativity from individuals was unleashed through this wonderfully democratic medium that can also sometimes be incredibly scary. That before that there was this need to sort of make all the content accessible to everybody and folk. Whereas now you can just talk about stuff you're interested in, and there'll be an audience for it. And your interest in it is what matters. And that's, you know, that's what you're doing. So
something a therapist once said to me. He said, you know, bring your passion to something, no matter what it is. Like, so if you're a chef or you're, you know, mechanic, you know, it doesn't have to be just in the arts, you know, but you have to bring the passion to it. And the people that you like the people that you like to hire for something are the people who have brought their passion to it. And that's just a good thing to remember.
Yeah.
Anyway,
as I say, I've become a fan of the podcast, and I've really, really enjoyed this conversation. It's been such a delight. Great to hear your perspective on so many things. Paul, thank you so much. This has been a real pleasure.
It's kind of amazing that you asked me to do this and that I got to talk about myself to the point where I might be sick of talking about myself, which is, I'll tell my wife, that's kind of a new thing for me to be sick of talking about myself. But anyway, thank you. Thank you for having me. And I hope something I said is useful to somebody else. Okay.
Well, it's been useful to me. Thank you.
Well, that's enough. Okay. Well, thanks, man. Thanks for asking me. I really am humbled to be here. Thank you.
That's musician, journalist, podcaster, and author Paul Myers. I got to tell you, I really enjoyed that conversation. I really appreciated Paul's perspective on so many things, and there's a lot I take away from this. Just that message about our relationship with music, I found that really fascinating. I love that quote from Mel Brooks about hoping for the best and expecting the worst. But most of all, I just love the fact that Paul is doing what he loves. And while he acknowledges that it's not always easy, it still feels like work sometimes, it is clear he is doing exactly what he should be doing. So I encourage you to check out the Record Store Day podcast and Paul's books. You can find links in our show notes. And once again, a big thank you to Paul Myers for joining us on Digging Deep. And if you enjoyed this episode, I have a favor to ask of you. Please review it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen and share it with a couple of people you think would enjoy our discussion. That's going to help us reach more people and produce more great episodes. And one last thing, if you want to keep digging deep into topics and lessons like this, I have a weekly newsletter that I send out. I know that you probably already get lots of stuff in your inbox, but this one is very quick and it's right to the point. It's 5 very short items I've discovered each week. It takes about 2 minutes to read, and I'm sure you're going to find something in it that you can apply immediately to your life. So please subscribe to the Weekly Dig at letsdigdeep.com. That's letsdigdeep.com. And get ready for more great stories and powerful lessons on the next edition of Digging Deep. Thank you for listening.
Have you ever thought, I'd love to have a podcast just like this one? Well, I can help. My name is Matt Kundle, and everyone at my company, the Sound Off Podcast Network, had a hand in making this show. Whether it was about the sound, the discoverability, or that you're just enjoying the show, we are all about the detail. If you think you have a podcast in you, reach out to me via email, matt@soundoff.network. Or check out the website and become one of the great podcasts we work with at soundoff.network.